So welcome to Linux Fuzz. So, welcome to Linux Voice Series 4, Episode 10. I'm 11, Andrew Gregory.
11.
11. Oh, Christ.
If only it was Episode 10, how things would be better.
Oh, dear. So, welcome to Linux Voice Episode 11. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And you're Mike Saunders, right?
Mike Saunders.
Absolutely awesome. So, in this news today, everything's gone wrong, so Ben's only doing happy news. We have a halfway reminder, we have Finds of the Fortnight, we also have the voice de la Massoir, as I believe our European partners would say. However, enough of this European nonsense, we have liberated ourselves from their octopus-like clutches. Instead, we can bring you this positive message that you can subscribe to Linux Voice at shop.linuxvoice.com. PDFs, EPUBs, and also ye olde paper subscriptions are available, none of which are encumbered with any form of DRM. So you can download, share, all of that stuff, and please do so. Right, time for news.
Right, on with the news. As Andrew mentioned, our country is crumbling around us, so we're ignoring all the bad things that are happening and focusing on all the only positive news from the last fortnight or so. So, first of the positive news stories this week is that 2% of the world uses Linux. So there's various ways of sort of guessing, mostly based on popular websites, seeing which web browsers are visiting them and sort of reporting what operating system they're using. So according to net market share, there's 2%. According to W3Counter, 2.48%. According to other people, there's varying other percentage, the percentages. And for sort of years, this has been growing. It sort of used to be, everyone used to round it up to 1% sort of back in the day, and it sort of gradually picked its way up. And we've said it's been around 1% for a long time, but really it has been steadily increasing. We've just always rounded it down or up to 1%. Now it's crossed the 2% threshold on, to be honest, most of the guesstimates of global Linux usage. And this isn't including Android in general. They separate Android. So this is GNU/Linux, or general desktop Linux is.
That's a huge number then, if it's just the desktop alone. I mean, that's in a lot of industries people would say 2%, that's nothing, but in the PC world that is tens of millions. I don't know, maybe hundreds of millions of computers.
Oh, certainly hundreds of millions. I'm sure.
All those Ubuntu TVs.
Indeed.
But doesn't that discount Ubuntu TVs and discount all the hundreds of millions of servers that are in Apache and discount all the tablets and the phones?
So discount Android, it would count anything that hit a website. So if someone had put Firefox on their server and was searching the web on it, it would count it. But that person should probably be shot for installing Firefox on a web server and surfing the web on it. Of course, one of the exceptions to that is Mike, who does have links running on his server.
W3M all the way.
I've no idea how Ubuntu identifies on phones, so that may or may not be included, but that's 0.0002% or whatever.
So if you've got a web, web server, and then you install Firefox on that server and you use that to browse the web, that counts.
That would count, but
but who would do that? What's that? That's just it seems
that,
like a
that
daft
is a daft
to
thing to do, which is why people wouldn't do it.
Okay, that's good. Carry on. I'm glad that we live in a world where people don't do daft things.
Indeed.
Yes, we do.
I mean, I've often thought that these counts underestimate Linux use in general, because I think that people using other operating systems tend to browse the web more. So if you're sat on your Windows computer and just all you do is browse the web all day, that is going to count more than one person who sits on a Linux computer, I don't know, writing code all day and occasionally looking at websites. These are very, very rough guesses based on the number of hits on websites. So you shouldn't put too much credence on them. But I think it is showing that Linux is increasing, although whether that's 2% or whether that's 5%, we can't really say from these figures.
I'd say anecdotally, more people seem to be using it than ever. And it was like 5 or 6 years ago, you'd go to a tech conference and so many people would be there with their Apple MacBook Pros. And I don't notice that so much anymore at all, really. It's almost like there are very few Macs. Lots of people have generic laptops, and lots of them are running Linux because lots of them are, like, you know, using loads of terminals usually and doing stuff that way. And there's the Chrome OS as well, which seems very popular.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure if that includes Chrome OS numbers, which, yeah, is becoming hugely popular. It's been the best-selling thing on desktops, laptops on Linux. I've lost my words. It's been the best-selling laptops on Amazon for quite a while now. So, yeah, I think
great.
A positive story to start our positive news section with.
I feel so much better.
Positive news. Yes. Good news.
Our second positive news story is that Bulgaria has just implemented a law requiring all software written for the government to be open source. So any contracts the government gives out, you know, needing new software, being custom written, they have to be open source and they have to be in a public repository. The Deputy Prime Minister said that it was to stop software being left vulnerable when the contract expired and to detect bad security practices before it got to that point, which are, yeah, there are many good reasons to use open source software. That is two of them.
Excellent. What county is Bulgaria in?
It comes under the Ministry of Foreign Office and Culture,
Let's send
Media
Boris.
And Sport. Let's send Uncle Bulgaria and his other fumbles.
Yes.
Scenes were played by Ray Winston. On a more serious note, I went to Bulgaria in approximately 1988. And it was really hot and you couldn't get proper ice cream. There was a parade of there was some sort of national holiday. There was a parade with banners and, like, young children in national dress, and people were holding aloft banners of Lenin and Stalin and people, and it was weird. I didn't really understand it was weird being only eight, but my mum thought it was weird and she took loads of photographs. So we've got photographic evidence of weirdness. Whereas I just enjoyed building sandcastles. And I think there's something that we could all learn from that.
Yeah. Yeah. Holiday at home this year.
Yeah, so, back in 1998, you were exposed to pictures of Stalin and Lenin, and then you took a career in communist software magazine reporting.
1988. Yeah, that's right. That's how it went. That, to be fair, that wasn't the only formative experience of my childhood. Okay. Other things happened to me.
Yeah.
Was that time you got locked in a cupboard? I remember that.
That was in Belgium.
The way you said, "I remember that," implied you were the one who locked him in there.
No. This is purely from the descriptive qualities of Andrew's prose.
Oh God, yeah. That's why I've had a deep mistrust for Brussels, and it's unelected.
You're not alone.
I know this is digressing from the news somewhat, but I've just come back from the pub, and there was a bloke there said that if only. So one theory is that the Brexit vote was a kicking of the elites to show that, you know, you people with your Eton and Oxbridge education, you know, you want us to go one way. However, we're not sheep. We will rebel against you and we will do this. So this chap had this theory that if only the Arctic research ship had proceeded with the name Boaty McBoatface, then the British public's faith in democracy would have been assuaged, and therefore we would have got it all out of our system and just gone along with the status quo.
Maybe people thought it was a bit like the Boaty McBoatface thing, where you can just vote for a joke and they'll do something sensible anyway.
Yeah. That's what normally happens.
Right, it feels a little bit like we're straying away from the positivity of the news section here. So in an attempt to keep it back on track, I shall move on to more positive news. Servo, the new next generation browser engine from Mozilla, is now available in nightly builds. So this is basically a multi-threaded rendering engine for your web browser that will eventually replace the thing in the middle of Mozilla or Firefox. So it'll be able to make much better use of multi-core CPUs to allow you to look at pictures of kittens on the internet much, much quicker than you can presently.
So is Firefox single threaded at the moment?
Not completely, but mostly. So if you've got, quad-core CPU.
Represents a massive step forward in the way that most people use their browsers is to have, you know, loads of tabs open.
Yeah, it's not, even within a single tab, it will be able to distribute the load much better between the different cores on your CPU. It's not just one tab, one core, or one core.
And will it have the process isolation stuff so that a tab won't be able to lock up the browser?
No idea, to be honest. As it's splitting it more across the different cores, you would, even if it doesn't isolate it that well, it should, you know, you shouldn't be able to just lock up the single thread and kill everything.
Well, one thing's nice is that the Mozilla guys are working on this, working on something that's core and central to the browser, because I've got nothing against Rust and the other things they're doing. It's just as their browser market share is declining, it's quite helpful if they focus on their core asset.
Yeah, I mean, they have done some really interesting things that have ended up not really doing much, like their phone. That does a phone even still exist, or has that disappeared now?
I don't think so.
No. So yeah, hopefully,
I used to think that Mozilla's decisions were sometimes crazy, but now that I've got a sense of scale, I think that they probably made some very sensible decisions.
We should have hopefully a faster web browser in the not too distant future. And we have one more item on our positive news. This positive news seems to be going much faster than our usual negative news. We're just as ingrained in our Britishness to be much better at grumbling than talking positively about things.
What are you saying about our Britishness? Are you not proud?
I'm incredibly...
Take back control, everybody.
Somebody write his name down.
I'm incredibly proud of our ability to grumble about everything. The bit where you get through to probably about May time in the year and everyone starts, it's been raining for so long. Oh, this rain, it's terrible. Then by June, barely 2 weeks later, the sun's too hot.
It's too hot for me. Too hot this.
There's genuinely nothing that we can't have a good grumble about, and it's quite an impressive ability, really. So it is taking us out of our natural comfort zone in our positive news section. So let's get it swiftly over with and go back to grumbling about stuff. Or would it?
This is how the metropolitan elite talk, is it?
Ben, you're living in a Westminster bubble.
Put your latte down.
What about the membership? What about the 150,000 who paid their £3?
just wanted to have a happy news section for once. Was that too much to ask? There's been so much negative news. I thought, well, we'll just have some nice positive things about free software doing good things in the world and sort of progressing the state of Linux forward. And we could sort of get behind them and think that everything wasn't so dire, but apparently not. Apparently it's all gone terrible.
Sorry, Ben.
It's all right. So, our last item of news, our positive news set up this fortnight, is Skype for Linux is back, sort of. After sort of it was basically abandoned by Microsoft over the last couple of years, and a bit rotted to the point where it didn't really work anymore. A new client is available. It's obviously not open source or any such nonsense, but it does allow you to use Skype from Linux and communicate with people on other operating systems.
Has Microsoft said why they've done this?
Probably because they love Linux.
Well, maybe now that Linux is 2.8%, maybe they see that there's a market opportunity.
Indeed.
Well, to be fair, what I mean, I imagine that if you wrap up the whole of the Windows operating systems, they would account for what 70-odd%. But if you break things down, I mean, what does Windows 7 or Windows 10 or the other one or XP or, you know, I'm pretty sure that the least popular Windows OS can't be too far off 2.0%.
Windows 3.1 is probably about 0.1%.
Well, all right. But I mean, if the more modern operating systems, I mean, people generally shunned Windows 7, didn't they?
Vista was awful.
Sorry,
yeah.
Vista. Has Linux overtaken Vista yet?
I'll quickly Google. Probably.
Is Vista the Jeremy Corbyn of operating systems grimly clinging on?
According to the graph I've just pulled up, it just disappears after Linux and goes to other. But as it doesn't have a Windows Vista bar, I assume Vista goes in other.
Cool.
So yeah, for a full breakdown, Windows 7 is the most popular at about 50%, and Windows 10 at about 20%, Windows XP at 10%-ish, Windows 8.1 at 8.01%. Something vaguely nice about that. OS X at 5%, Windows 8 at 2.45%, and Linux at 2.02%. This is net market shares.
So Linux is really knocking at the door of Windows 10 and Mac OS 10?
Not that much. I mean, it was about half of Mac OS 10, a bit less than half of it.
No, but that is statistically significant.
Is.
I mean, if you're, you know, 2% versus 5%, that is a comparable amount. It's not like we're comparing 2% to 50%. That's in the same ballpark. I mean, it's getting beaten, but it is at least playing the same game.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's absolutely fantastic.
And that's the positive-ish news this fortnight.
I feel so much better now. I don't know what I was worried about. So that leads us on to finds of the fortnight. Three weeks if I manage to edit this in the next day. It's quite late on the Thursday night, so I did ask the IRC channel, and once again they've come through for us. They've, even though they seem to be mildly obsessed with RSS readers, that's okay. They suggested three of them. One of them is Quite RSS is a great RSS client on Linux. That's by Zed Moylan. And then to steal Zed Moylan's thunder, Ian Gogo says Canto is an ncurses-based RSS reader that is daemon client bazzers. Don't know what that means. But then there's another console one called Newsbeater, which he says is very, very good. Zed Moylan also says that the Vivaldi browser is okay if Chrome and Firefox irk you. But this is followed up by Tracy C saying that they wanted to like Vivaldi, but they didn't. On Windows, it has a visual bug that meant the fonts went in and out of focus and there was too much flickering. RSS stuff on the command line, I've never tried it. I should try it because I do a lot of my other stuff on the command line. I haven't been very good. Oh, and Ian GoGo says Pokemon Go is now in the UK. Which I thought you'd mention, actually, Ben, considering, was it the... It's by the same Google Android company that you, one of your finds was, the Inception or whatever it was on Android.
Oh, yeah. I've just suddenly gone
I think
blank
it's the same developers or the same team that have been farmed off from Alphabet, and they've gone and created this phenomenon for Nintendo.
Why is it so popular? I really don't understand it. You go outside and you look at stuff and the Pokemon will appear. If you had to, you remember Barcode Battler back in the day? It was also silly, but the idea was you may find on some Coke bottle or some random thing in your house the perfect barcode to create the perfect thing. But I don't see any of that in Pokemon Go. I mean, I have no idea what I'm talking about. So, but why is it so popular?
Have you got Pokemon Go in Germany yet?
I have no ideas. I've seen some friends on Facebook talking about it, but I know it's possible to download APKs and things like that. I saw on Facebook somebody was trying to organize, I think it was in Frankfurt, a mass stoning of Pokemon Go users. So I don't think it's gone down very well.
Oh, that famous German tolerance.
Excellent.
No, I get the appeal of it. It sort of takes the sort of computer games are quite good at sort of giving you sort of gratification, do this little bit and you get this level, and it sort of motivates you through it. And I think they've got very good in the last sort of 5-6 years of getting the levels just right. So it's, oh, just that little bit more, and oh yeah, that feels good, and sort of giving that warm, fuzzy feeling when you're sort of gradually building up. And this is sort of taking that, but taking you outside into the real world and got 3D graphics, and you don't even have to wear a headset. The resolution's absolutely fantastic. Just the trees wafting in the wind look absolutely real.
There has also been some issues, though. I know people were going around places like the Auschwitz Museum trying to collect Pokemons, and so there's been suggestions they should introduce some GPS data in there so people will do it in more appropriate locations.
Let me interject here. That is a problem with Nintendo. However, I imagine that they generate most of their data automatically and on the fly according to some sort of algorithm. That is a problem with the people who are doing it, with the people who've got their mobile phones in front of their faces at the Holocaust Museum or at Auschwitz or at Dachau or at somewhere where you really shouldn't be hunting for fictional cartoon characters. Instead, you should be taking in the gravity of your surroundings and what it means for you and all of humanity. That is not Nintendo's fault. That is your fault as a human being for being a rubbish human being.
Right, and there was one more as well from the IRC channel, and that's SC Controller, which is a tool for configuring Steam controllers, which I don't think was possible to do outside of SteamOS. Steam controllers, I haven't got one, even though they've been on sale recently, are the weird touchpad games controllers. That's from Ian GoGo as well. So they're the finds from IRC. Anyone want to have a go at their find? I've got one. It's only a small one, and I can't admit to actually having tried it yet, but it sounds very cool. It's CIOPFS, which is a fuse file system, a user file system that a user can mount in Linux that is case insensitive. So basically loopbacks your own file system and makes anything that accesses the files and folders through CIOPFS. They won't care less about whether something's a capital or whether something's lowercase, which is useful if you're running Wine apps or badly ported code that really hasn't taken into consideration the upper and lowercase of Linux file systems. And that's it. It's a cool, neat utility.
I've got to find. Somebody's uploaded the source code to the Apollo guidance computer onto GitHub.
Oh, yes.
You may have seen this, Graham. I mean, it's hard to describe. I guess it is a sort of assembly language, and it is a processor of sorts that it's targeting. I think it's got a whopping 4 kilobytes of RAM. But it's really interesting looking through the code, because it's just like code from any other era. You know, there's this sort of nostalgia that, oh, everybody was great programmers back then, but there's still like question marks in there. And this was to try and land some people on the moon. Well, no wonder Neil Armstrong took over manually towards the end. But yeah, it's mostly gobbledygook to read, even if you are an assembly language geek like me, because the architecture is so obscure. But you know, to see code written in the 60s for an insanely important event, you might say only important for a couple of people, but obviously, you know, the image of the US was riding on it. It's well worth checking out. It's really well worth just browsing around.
So on a related note, is it hard to understand assembly language from the processors? Because aren't a lot of the instructions basically the same? They just map to different opcodes, you know, add, moving to registers is moving to registers.
If you're moving between CPUs of the same generation, you know, with the same capabilities, then yeah, it's not too difficult. I mean, you have some that are load store and some of them that are, you know, working in a different way. It's when you, especially when you go back to much more primitive processors, if you start looking at Z80 and 6502 used in 8-bit computers, you know, they didn't have proper multiply or divide instructions. So people put those in the code. You know, they had more limited registers. So yeah, to some extent you can transfer around, but when you go to when you jump generations, then you the language looks very, very different.
Okay.
It is amazing. I'm still, I mean, I know we're all kind of geekish, but to think that, like, I don't know, going to the moon occurred something like just after 40 years after people had first flown across the Atlantic. You know, so much had changed, and, you know, within decades we were going into space and landing on the moon. Really amazing, an incredible achievement.
And now we haven't been back there for 44 years.
I mean, yeah. I think, yeah, that's true. But I think the Mars rovers are pretty incredible. I mean, you know, they're the size of a car. You know, they've got nuclear reactors in them. They've been up there for years doing great scientific work. I mean, in some ways, okay, there's a beautiful kind of idealism to putting humans on places, but the fact is that Romans can do that.
What did the Romans do for us on Mars?
Well, there is an absolutely wonderful photograph of Margaret Hamilton with the printout of the code from Apollo, one of the Apollos. And she's only 5 foot now, but it is like a massive stack of just a massive stack of code. And like, that's it's absolutely wonderful. It's like a tangible.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not tangible because it's only a photograph, but it captures a moment where code was that could be encapsulated by a single human brain. Like the code that's going to take the SpaceX rockets up, for example, that's going to be absolutely enormous. That's going to be worked on by an enormous team of people, and no one person is going to be able to understand it all. But at that brief moment in the late 60s, one person could practically, you know, look at that and go, oh yeah, I get what that means, I understand what that means, and, you know, send men into space. That's absolutely, absolutely, utterly fantastic. And it's such a, I mean, we live in such a golden age in that these people are here and around and walking on Earth, and we can ask them questions. And computer science is still in its infancy. And we're here to enjoy it. It's utterly amazing.
Pokemon Go is the ultimate expression of that.
But here we are, wasting up. Graham has just trolled me.
Thanks, Mike. Ben and Andrew, got any finds?
Yep, my find is JavaScript. Obviously, JavaScript has been around for a while. However, my find is that if you want to learn programming and logic and variables and greater than, less than, etc., JavaScript is a really good place to start, because what I found is that a lot of languages start off with hello world, which is utterly useless, because if you're in an email client, if you're in a web browser, if you're in a word processor, you can just type the words hello world and they appear on your screen. So no, you're laughing, but
I agree.
To be fair, I think the reason hello world is popular is because if it works, it shows that your tool chain is working, your compiler or your interpreter, whatever.
But if you're there, if you're learning a programming language on day one, who cares at all that your tool chain is working? That should not be a consideration. Yeah. That should be utterly irrelevant. It should be taken for granted that your tool chain works. Who cares what a tool chain is? It doesn't matter.
Well, if you're typing away your code and you try to get something to work and it's not working, you're sort of debugging it, whatever, but it turns out that it's your compiler that's broken in the first place, you need to know that it's working.
Right. Honestly, if you are learning a language, who wants to take the trouble to learn, to discover that their tool chain is working or not? It should be utterly... It's like if you're learning to write and you have to stop and work out whether your paper is okay or whether there's a problem in your ink or whether there's a bug in your pen. It's utterly irrelevant. It should be utterly irrelevant. It isn't irrelevant because of, I don't know what, because of overwhelming complexity that's been introduced by people who really just care too much about their own knowledge and just don't want to involve others. Oh, shut up, dog.
Right, and this is why JavaScript is so good.
So my discovery is that JavaScript, you can pick it up, you can just enter a few commands and get an actual result in that a window alert pops up. And we're all used to being on the internet, being on web browsers, looking at websites and having things pop up in front of us. And the fact that you can make that happen within... two or three lines of code makes JavaScript wonderfully accessible. And obviously Python is fantastically readable, but I would strongly recommend JavaScript because its results are tangible and absolutely observable. And that's why I recommend JavaScript.
Have you done some stuff with JavaScript that recently then?
I've got to page 65 in JavaScript The Missing Manual.
Awesome.
And that is the furthest I've got in any programming language, because everything else, all the other books have all been, oh, well, this is Hello World, or this is how you do some irrelevant nonsense that I just don't care about. Whereas, JavaScript, I mean, I probably won't spend too long with JavaScript once I've learned how to use it, but it is a way of introducing, logic and contract and else if, etc., and variables. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant way to just get into programming, and it makes sense.
Brilliant. Thanks, Andrew. That leaves you, Ben.
Yes. My discoveries this fortnight are, well, firstly, Software Heritage, which is a website that they collect, preserve, and share all software publicly available in source form. So basically, it's like archive.org, the Internet Archive, but for free software, basically. And the idea is that, it's available now, but as time goes on, stuff changes, archives disappear, if, I don't know, SourceForge ran out of money and went down, suddenly, the projects that were being maintained would be moved on to other services, but a lot of them would just die because they're not being used anymore. But that software, that's still important. It's part of our culture. It's part of who we are. It's part of the systems we run every day, even if it's not, used by huge numbers of people. It's a part of our culture that was there, and it should be preserved.
It's sort of like the ultimate incarnation of what Linus Torvalds said, wasn't it? Real men don't make backups. They simply upload their work to FTP servers and let everybody else mirror it.
Indeed. This will, it's one way of just not having to back up your repositories, I guess. But I think it is. It's something that's not necessarily important now because everything they've got is still publicly available. But in 20 years' time, when you think, oh, that utility I used, how did it work? And you can actually go back and see the source code because it's been saved and it's still available. That's when it becomes important, I think.
Yeah. Also, I imagine that in the future, there'll be all kinds of, Anthropic kind of science you can do on source code and how source code kind of evolves over the decades, that, you know, a repository like that would be really interesting.
Yeah, because they save all the metadata as well. It's not just the actual code. It's all as much information that they can grab about the commits and all that sort of thing. That's their mission. I don't know how complete they are at the moment for all projects, but that's what they're trying to do. And yeah, my second, this isn't really so much a discovery, actually. It's something that I'm working on. I'd be interested if any of our listeners have any experience in this. I'm doing a project with, trying to set up a Wi-Fi thing at the end of my garden, and it's not like a full Wi-Fi, you know, not set up a computer with Wi-Fi access, but a microcontroller. And it's right at the edge of the Wi-Fi range. So I've got a little microcontroller board, which you can plug an antenna into. And I've got like the regular little whip antenna that comes with it. But I'm looking into things like the Cantenna, where you hack a food can into making it supposedly a very good directional antenna. And if anyone has any experience with these sorts of things, I'd be really interested to hear. Because some people claim on the internet, at least, have had very good results with it. But I don't know.
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, I've done things like replace antennas on new wireless routers with bigger ones from older ones, and it works, and you get a stronger signal from doing something as simple as that. So. And we know, you know, everything seems so directional with Wi-Fi, at least when it comes to things getting in the way and the signal being boosted or not.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm going to be trying that out over the next couple of weeks. And, see how it goes.
Awesome. So they were our finds.
Wonderful. Finds are great. It's there's such a massive world out there. So now it's the time for the halfway
getting
reminder.
Smaller.
So no, Graham. The world is getting bigger because we are unrestricted by the old malarkey. We are free to go out and find our own world, unfettered by, etc.
Over to Germany.
and here in Germany, I can report there are no neurons.
Therefore, it's time to go on to Voice of the Masses, which is provided by the people. However, one of the wonderful things about the people of Voice of the Masses is that they are, I don't want to put a value judgment on things, but they're better than most people. They're just better morally, intellectually. They're sexier than most people. They're just more awesome people. So our question was, Voice of the Masses, how did you discover Linux? Where did your journey begin? Maybe you saw it on the cover disc of a magazine somewhere. Maybe a magazine that we worked on. Or a friend recommended that you try it. Perhaps your company switched to Linux, which encouraged you to install it at home. Or you simply became so enraged with Windows that you had to find something else. In any case, let us know. So, John Gibbs, he says, what? You mean you don't have to use Windows? But this is 1996. There's no way I'll get the Aureal Vortex 2 sound driver working on this Red Hat thing. Oh, wait, I did. It works. And the rest is history. TLDR, sheer curiosity.
As long as you know the IRQ for that sound card and the DMA mode for it.
Well, Andrew Conway says, my dad installed Slackware for me on a first-gen Pentium desktop in 1995. I use it for my work on solar flare physics research.
Oh. Wow!
God, Andrew, he's just too cool. And for £1,000, £1,000 in 1995, that must have been worth at least €500, it outperformed some workstations that cost 5 to 10 times more. Plus, I could listen to CDs using software called Workbone. I switched to Red Hat after a few years, then switched to Windows, mainly because of Office Docs arriving attached to ever more frequent emails. Wow. The amazing thing there is that you can use Slackware to save you up to 10 times the amount of money. It's you three over there. Have you... When you started using Linux, was it to save money?
Not in my case, no. It was I had an Amiga and it was fantastic. And then Commodore was absolutely appalling in everything that they did and destroyed the Amiga. So, well, what I ended up with a Windows computer for a while, and then I think I was 17 or 18 and I saw Red Hat 5.1 on the cover of PC Direct magazine in a supermarket. And that was it.
So is this relevant to saving money, Mike?
Oh, no.
Just to cut you short.
Absolutely not,
we have. All right. Wonderful. So, Stephen Wheeler, I first heard about Linux when the now defunct Guardian Tech supplement, I remember that, did a cover story about Linux and specifically Red Hat. They put an illustration of a red bowler hat on the cover. Wow. Imaginative. With the article featuring an interview with Bob Young, it also included an explanation of free software. Open source wasn't a thing back then, and so introduced me to the idea of software freedom. Ah, wow, that just sounds fantastic. Imagine that actually being introduced to you. Ashley Strutt, I was looking for something reliable in 2003 and saw an article in the magazine. Switched straight away because I had enough unreliable Windows, which I can't remember how to use anymore. I can't use Windows nowadays. Ray Woods says, from across W.A. Smith's, on the cover of a magazine, but it wasn't until a few years later when I tried SUSE 10.2 and became hooked, dumped Windows XP on my desktop. Very quickly after that, Vista on our laptop fell to Linux Mint 5. Okay, cool. So Chloe Wolfgirl says, I was at college. We had to install an operating system. We put an installation disk in the computer and Ubuntu with Unity showed up. I liked the look of it. It looked very modern and usable. Wow, that's so Chloe Wolfie Girl at college tried Ubuntu with Unity. I really genuinely expected most of the comments to read something like, oh, I installed Slackware in 1993, there was a slack of floppy disks 2 foot high. But actually, people are coming to Linux at all ages and at all times. I was studying, Dick says, I was studying for a HND and saw a television advert with RMS talking about free software. I thought I should look into that. John Orford said, a friend described Linux as, Debian's APT as a living organism. Nate says, hackers. Seriously, I was a punk kid in the 90s who fancied himself as a hacker. Someone I met online recommended Linux. I already disliked Windows and Mac at the time. It was horrid. So there you have it. There's like a massive range of,
that's so cool. I mean, that's great.
Times and motivations and people coming towards Linux. Ben, why did you first start using Linux?
I had a little bit of a play around with it in the sort of late 90s, but never really, you know, got started with it. And the time it stuck was when I was going to uni. They had like a reading list and stuff to do over the summer before the first year. And one of them was, they didn't say you had to do it, but it was like a recommended thing, was to get familiar with Linux. And I think the first thing I installed and used for a bit was SUSE. But I settled on Red Hat for my, you know, I don't know, can't even remember why anymore. Yeah, and used that, on the machine I took to uni with, which was Yeah, it was a first-gen Pentium machine, and about 5 years old at that point, and just chunked away. And it worked better than Windows had been doing it, because it's an old Windows 95 machine that had been running it for 5 years and ground to a halt. And then suddenly, I put, I think it was a KDE desktop booted up, and it looked better than Windows did, and it ran better than Windows did. And it still seemed quite magical that it was just all available for free, and this thing called open source that just somehow appeared on magazine cover discs and whatnot and enabled you to run it.
Nathan Oleander says, I don't remember how I heard about Linux on the whole originally, but I got started using it because I was curious. I think most people use it because they're curious. My grandpa had spilled coffee on his laptop and it didn't work, so he took it to a tech friend of his and ended up just buying a new one. Turns out the laptop was actually fine, so I ended up getting it. Fantastic. Linux resurrects old hardware. Graham, go on, add something to this discussion.
Okay, well, I tried it before. I've said about the story before on an Amiga, but what really caught my imagination was I was living in this country called France, and the French Mandrake Linux, was a French distribution, famously created by Gaël Duval. And there's a magazine in France, I don't know if it's still going, but this is about 1999, called Planet Linux. And it would put on its cover discs the latest release of Mandrake before anybody else. And I genuinely got so excited whenever there was, every 6 months, there was a new Mandrake release. And because there was no internet to speak of, I had dial-up, which cost a fortune in France. And so coming home like a school kid with the latest Mandrake discs, 7.1, 7.2, see what so much had changed in 6 months, especially with KDE. I really have fond memories of that and the early Mandrake and putting something on your computer that you had complete control over.
Didn't France have their own sort of text-based internet thing back in the day? I don't know, maybe they still have it.
They had that thing on their phone that was kind of bolted onto their phones, yeah. Mm. It was like a telex with a little LCD screen and a keyboard so you could send messages to people and stuff like that.
Could you download stuff on it?
It wasn't connected to a computer, at least. I never had one, so I don't know. But the internet was slightly behind the UK. It was at the time where in the UK there were ISPs who gave you free access. Do you remember? It was like Dixon's and places
that. Whereas advert banner along the bottom.
Yeah. Whereas, things were kind of changing in the UK, whereas at least where I was in France, I can remember using Magios and Fnac, which was a record store, for their as cheap as I possibly could get internet. But then you still had the telephone calls on top of that. It doesn't feel that long ago, but actually, thinking about the time, it is. It's getting on to 20 years, isn't it?
That's the scary thing about time. Ian says, Red Hat Linux for Dummies book, late 1990s, with CD inside the back cover. Installed it and fought with configuring X. Brian Hammond says, remembering sometime around 1994-ish, I found out that Slackware from a local BBS, too bad I spent more time booting into OS 2 so I could look for help to get it working. I had an on-off-again relationship with it for a few years, finding Debian 7 or 8 years later. Don says, Raspberry Pi. Last century. Oh, it's awesome that we are of an age where we can say that. And it actually means something. Last century, I tried converting a Windows machine to dual boot with Linux. This was a terrible experience that cured me of Linux for decades. Following retirement and with the arrival of Raspberry Pi, I thought I would try again. 3 Pis followed by 2 dual boot machines, defaulting to Ubuntu 16.04 later. And after setting up my grandson with a Linux machine, I am hooked. The Raspberry Pi is a conduit for people using Linux. Discuss.
Yeah, I bet if we put this question up in another 5 years' time, there would be a lot of people saying the Raspberry Pi. I mean, there's how many millions there are now? 6 million Raspberry Pis sold? And obviously quite a few people have multiple ones and quite a few of them have gone into industry. But that's a lot of them will have gone to people who have never used Linux before. And
yeah. Same way that we're talking about Amigas, or at least Mike and I are saying, you know, the Raspberry Pi in, the Raspberry Pi in its way is the Amiga of its day.
Don also says Raspberry Pi. Justin Furmeister Clark says Linux Mint Cinnamon back in 2008. Andrew Bowden says he was at university in the late 1990s. Quickly found that Pine was a far faster way of getting my email than using Netscape Navigator. It is. There is a great big spread of people who all use Linux for all sorts of different reasons, which is what one would expect, really. I think I use Linux because, well, actually, no, I was introduced to Linux because I started work on a magazine about Linux. However, it's one thing to start using Linux, but it's another thing to stay with it. And I stay with it now because I cannot imagine paying for software that does stuff when actually free software does it better or just as good as. The idea that you have to pay and subscribe to a license for things just seems utterly nonsensical when you can download stuff for free.
It's quite interesting that we can have this discussion about, oh, yeah, how did you start using Linux and that sort of thing. If you tried to do the same with Windows or Mac OS, it would be a completely nonsensical question. Why did you start using Windows?
Yeah.
Because I bought a computer.
Yeah.
Why did you start using Mac OS? Because I bought a fancy computer. It's just... Whereas Linux, there's actually a reason that you start using it. There's something attracts you, some aspect of it that you genuinely like, rather than it just being the default option.
Well, that was very positive. I feel a bit better.
Good.
Yeah, that'll do. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. So, adieu, everyone. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. It's such a